ever gone to a library and thought, this is where I'm going to start a software company? Me neither, but today's guest did, and in 2010 collected an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year award along the way. He joins me today to talk about the issue of data sprawl in the cloud, hybrid work, and perhaps share a few things he's learned about migrating his business from an on-prem to cloud model while we're at it. But before we do, two things. First, I would love it if you could give us a thumbs up and leave us a quick review on whatever player you're listening to this on. It makes a massive difference to us. And second, thanks again to Rocket Software for making today's episode possible. If you haven't already, check out their gorgeous new website. It really is very, very cool as part of their rebranding at rocketsoftware.com to see why over 10 million IT professionals rely on them every day to run their most critical business applications, processes, and data. With that, welcome to another episode of Digital Disrupted with me, your host, Paul Muller. And today I'm joined by CEO and co-founder of AvePoint, Dr. TJ Chang. How are you, DJ?
Very good. It's good to be here. Thank you, Paul. Good morning.
It's great to have you. Welcome to Digital Disrupted. Hey, before we jump into the topic of, well, a whole number of topics, but I'd like to hear a bit more about how you founded a business in a library. That's a heck of a library card you must have. But before we do that, we have something we call the lightning round. Chance for our audience to get to know our guests through a slightly quirky lens. You ready to have a bit of fun?
Yeah.
Let's do this thing. First question, drum roll. TJ, what would people say is your superpower?
Eternal optimism. You know, as an entrepreneur, we have to be always optimistic.
I don't think that one needs any explanation. If you've ever been an entrepreneur, we're all nodding, going, yes. Okay, the most disruptive technology of all time. Now, you're an engineer. I'm curious to hear what you have to say.
For me personally, because I'm my background in electrical computer engineering, I would say transistor is the most disruptive. It brings forth the computer and PCs and then the information age with internet. It all started with the transistors.
And where are you based?
I'm based in Jersey City, New Jersey. And
so I went just around the corner from where it was invented.
That's right. Yeah. My first job out of school was with Bell Labs, Lucent Bell Labs. Before that, there was AT&T. That's where they invented a lot of this cool stuff.
The OG place where it all began. The original Silicon Valley, I guess.
That's right.
Don't tell the West Coasters. All right. The best quality a leader can have.
The best quality a leader can have is really servant leadership. It's lead by example.
I try and practice it every day. It's very cool. We actually had a wonderful podcast on the topic of servant leadership and some of that stuff going back about a year ago. So I might have to plug that one at the end of the show. All right, next question. Your advice to people starting their careers?
Wow, that's a great question. Life's a marathon. Pace yourself. Don't take it too seriously. And consistency and persistence always win the race. So I recently read a lot of children's books to my kids because I have little children, and I have a whole new take on these children's books. So, you know, this hare versus turtle race, the hare never had a chance. The hare will lose the race every single time. Slow consistency and perseverance always win the race.
it's so true. And especially when you're an entrepreneur, there's no sprinting, right? You've got to take it a day at a time. I love that. All right. Who would have thought that children's books could be management consulting in disguise? All right. The first thought that comes to mind when you think about cloud and data sprawl.
First thing come to mind, it's complicated.
Well, the good news is we've got about 20, 30 minutes to dive into the topic. So we'll get to that in just a minute then. I like that. It's complicated. It's like my status on Facebook. All right, next one. And the last question, actually, if you could use technology to solve one world problem, you only get one, what would it be and why?
I would say climate change. You know, despite what others may say that we're not going to live on Mars anytime soon. We only got one home planet that everyone shares. We better take care of this little rock, you know? Otherwise, yeah, what's the future?
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. I think enough said on that one. All right, with that, I want to jump into this topic. First, tell us a bit about your background, and I'm going to have to ask you about the library at some stage.
So I'm actually, my parents are first-generation immigrants. They immigrated to the U.S. In the mid-80s as a first batch of exchange research scientists from Beijing. They're medical researchers, biophysics, in fact. And then I was lucky enough to come here with them. And when I was 11 years old, didn't know any English back then, and it has been a transformative experience. And living the American dream. Grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, went to public school, and then fortunate enough to go to Cornell for undergraduate engineering program. and then went to work for big banks. You know, the typical Asian immigrant story of go to good school and get a good job in big corporations. And then 9/11 happened, and that changed my world, changed everyone's world that went through it. My office is 40th floor of World Trade Center 1. So after that, and seeing everything that occurred, and luckily everyone on my floor survived that event. However, for me, I decided that, hey, while Wall Street salary is great, it's not a place I want to kind of be so specialized, so niched, that I don't have a broadened view of myself. So I went back to grad school and also made the fortunate choice of getting a doctorate in data mining and machine learning. And this is back in 2002, before big data is a term, by McKinsey in 2010. And while I was in grad school, my good friend and mentor, the gentleman I met at Luzhin Bell Labs, Kai Gong, started this business called AppPoint in Somerset, New Jersey Public Library. Because I was a graduate student, I have nothing better to do, right? Other than writing my thesis. So I joined him and we started this little endeavor. And yeah, fast forward 20 years later, here we are, a NASDAQ listed company, and doing really fun things and working with some of the best blue chip clients around the world.
That's just a fabulous story. And why the library? I'm curious.
So his wife actually kicked him out of his house. He bootstrapped the business for 3 years. We bootstrapped the business for 3 years. We didn't make any money in the first 3 years. And this is what I always tell entrepreneurs, right? The mindset, the entrepreneurial mindset should be that you just go into it because you're pursuing your passion. Don't expect it to become this multi-billion dollar company in 2 years' time. In fact, have the mindset that you're not going to make money at least for 3 years, and go at it and do the hard work and do the walk the hard yards and create something that the market and the customer actually really want. So yeah, so he had nowhere else to go except the public library because he was living in a friend's basement at that time.
That's unbelievable. So that actually leads right into my next question, which is going to be what some of your top learnings as an entrepreneur are, because I guess the popular myth, I think, is, and this is my perception talking to especially some younger people who have, a media influenced understanding of what Silicon Valley and software is like, is you have an idea, you pitch it to someone without doing any actual work, because the idea is the important thing, and that someone will give you Series A or, you know, angel funding, and you have a business, and then you flip it somehow and you make billions. That's the idealized, overly simplified version of it. What's been the experience?
I think that narrative, you're absolutely right. That's a pervasive narrative, but I think I have only seen one in a million occurrence of that narrative. The prevalent truth to entrepreneurship is one of really hard work. You actually have to produce products that people want to pay for it. Just imagine how hard it is to make, you know, money, right? To get a job and earn your first dollar. Now you're doing it as a company and you're producing things, especially for us, we're in the B2B space. So we're producing software for businesses who are by nature much more conservative, much more educated. And they will look at what they bring in to add real value. Otherwise, why would they, you know, kind of increase their CapEx or OpEx spending. So yeah, it's really demonstrating through hard work. Nothing happens without hard work. And you also have to be lucky. You have to be lucky to identify the market opportunities, produce things that folks want, the market need. And going forward, software is a space where I often say a year is eternity. Software has all the benefit of marginal cost of zero, distribution cost of zero. Effectively, you're making extra copy of software effectively at zero price, not like physical goods, and is as robust and rich as your imagination can take it. But the downside of it is that it's just something that people can also implement. So you have to innovate and move and change with the market. So it's a much faster iterating industry than your traditional physical goods industry.
And what about your experience with talent? Because I guess that's the other thing that, you know, I've met a lot of people who come to me and gone, look, I've got this idea. It's a little bit, I liken it to the Hollywood thing. I've got this idea for a film script. And my first thing to them is, if you haven't finished the film script, it's still an idea. No one's going to pay for it. And the same with software, right? If you haven't sketched it out to a degree that there's some, at least got some storyboards, some, you know, user stories, et cetera, that have got some meaning behind them. If you've not wireframed something, you don't have anything. But then find it, they say, I'm just struggling now to find the developers, to find the engineers to turn this into a reality. How hard is it during those early days to build a strong team? And especially, I suppose, during those early days, you start to accumulate some people who maybe aren't going to make it as the company grows. What's been your experience with talent?
My experience and my observation are formed by my history and background. I think some of the most successful tech entrepreneurs are techies themselves. Mm-hmm. You have to really write the code of your own first set of products yourself to truly understand how the product works and how, you know, the worth and market fit is. If you are completely a purely idea person and you outsource everything on Mechanical Turks, you know, websites and offshore development, it's a highly risky endeavor because you have no control over the quality of the code. And if you don't really understand what the code is doing, then that puts you at a massive disadvantage. So this is why oftentimes I would say 9 out of 10 times the successful tech entrepreneurs are the ones that write the codes themselves. Mm-hmm. So now, speaking of talent, you can find co-founders that are great at coding, who are your CTOs or co-CEOs, and that solves the problem as well. And also, I think with today's environment, the job as running a company is quite complex. So it's very difficult to find one single person that's good at everything, good at people management, good at marketing, good at sales, and also good at coding. So working partnership, have co-founders who complement each other in skill sets. I think that's very important because when you start a company, you have sweat equity. So you can use equity as a capability to attract and retain talent, and you have to give them, you know, the co-founder status. That's how you do it. All startups don't start off with tons of money. So yeah, in terms of talent acquisition, it's really the belief in creating your own destiny together.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to talk to you about it more. I remember my own experience going from like 25 million to 150 million to eventually a billion and then 3 billion. The team changed along the way, and some of the people who were there in the early days were not a really good fit as the business grew. And I'm just curious also what your experience has been on that. But maybe we should save that conversation to another day, because I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk a bit more about what you're doing at AvePoint.
But that's a great topic though, Paul. You know, it's very true. There's as you embark on the journey, there are people that can only walk part of the path with you, because as the company grow, like what you talk about, I also see natural thresholds to the growth of the business, but also maturity and sophistication of the business. And we all have to evolve. Otherwise, you know, we ourselves will not be able to further accelerate the business platforms. So I often say, if I stop being useful, I don't deserve this job. Someone else should take over this job. And that's how this team works. But as company grow though, Paul, one good thing is that the platform itself also becomes larger. So provided that you check your ego at the door, there's plenty of opportunities for talent to work different parts of the company. However, the ego part is the, you know, biggest thing, especially when you have folks that start with you in the early days and they feel like they're part of the co-founding group, and then they're no longer keeping up with their role and their side of the business. And if you want to allocate that person to a different side of business and their ego cannot accept it, that's when things start to fall apart.
I found that to be the hardest. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I always find you get to a certain point and you're like, I love you. And I mean, a lot of these people I'm talking about, I genuinely love.
That's right.
But you are not the right fit.
That's right.
I don't know how to put it any other way than, you know, we're going to need to bring in somebody else. You're not any less important.
That's right.
But you are not part of the, you know, maybe the board or this, you know, the bigger decision-making groups. And you can see it sometimes. Some people can take it, but other people, they become almost toxic because they're unable
yes.
to let go of that. And
yes.
you know, sometimes the hardest thing to do is just let them go.
Yes.
But it's probably the best. What was you know, I mean, you mentioned evolution. Have you had a particular problem that you've been working on as you've gone from, I guess, founder to running a much bigger business? Was there something you have consciously had to work on as a leader?
I feel that when we first started, we're all coders. So we were just writing our product. And then I had to learn how to sell, how to market. At the time, we don't have a big marketing department supporting customers. And over time, we start to build a team. Then we have to learn how to be better managers, how to scale, be better leaders, be able to delegate, be able to empower our team, and really get into that servant leadership style of you know, essentially, yes, demonstrate through example, but also trust your team to be able to kind of elevate the platform together. So that's on the management side. But as the company go bigger, now we're a public company, it's a different ballgame altogether. So we're, as I always say to my team, and we remind each other, we're in the big league now. You know, we're always compared to our peers who are all public companies. And these are all, you know, very top-notch, high-performance companies. And how do we elevate ourselves to that level? Of course, that necessitates bringing external senior expertise into the house and be able to, again, work with that cultural fit and be able to grow. So that's also important. Lastly, I would say that I was so just focus on running our business and focus on the problems that we have. Over time, I felt like I became too narrow and too niche. And then I actually joined another organization, a professional network organization that allowed me to expand my perspective and mindset and be able to communicate and converse with like-minded CEOs, family offices, and professional managers. And that's a massive personal learning, growth mindset learning for me. And that allowed me to take back to that point and be able to be more effective as a CEO.
You've clearly done a huge and tremendous job with that. Moving on to the topic of cloud and migrating to on-prem, because we're going to talk about the client side experience. But I'm curious, I know a lot of organizations are going through this at the moment. I know a lot of cloud native organizations, they're just like cloud first, forget on-prem. But there are a lot of organizations that are still partially stuck, especially with those systems they've built themselves, migrating them from on-prem or maybe even disposing of them, I'm not sure, going to a cloud-based delivery model. What were some of the big learnings you had as you tried to move from on-prem to cloud that maybe some of our business customers might be able to take advantage of?
Yeah, I think the major learning we have is don't think of it as just running your infrastructure in a different platform, right? Instead of your on-prem data center to somebody else's data center, which is called cloud. It's really about fundamentally change the way you think about how to reinvent your business. So nowadays, people have been talking about software eating the world. And nowadays, the prevailing consensus is that all businesses have to be software businesses, because for you to stay as a business, no matter which industry you are, to be competitive, right? You have to innovate through technology to be more productive. Leveraging cloud services like natural language processing, like machine learning and data mining to seek out a competitive advantage out of the data that you currently own and out of the business problem set that you're trying to solve. So I think that's ultimately the North Star for businesses. So in thinking that way, you have to think about fundamentally change the way you do business. For us, it's not so much of our putting our software. It used to be we deliver software on CDs and we update people every, you know, year. That's the old software delivery model. Now we actually run a platform in the cloud, which we update every 2 weeks for our 9 million plus users simultaneously. But because they're enterprise, we also have to consider these talk about sandboxing. So tenant level release rings, so they don't have to take the changes as they come in. And also tenant level patching. So if you have a specific large customer that have requirements, you need to be able to deliver changes to them. I would say the easiest for folks to understand this business model is think of the Tesla business model versus the GM business model, right? So in General Motors, something wrong with the car, they recall all the cars. In Tesla, because vast majority of the car are controlled by microprocessors, and you're actually improving the suspension, improving the speed control, improving different type of driving experience through the software, they can just update all the Tesla cars in one go. And they're getting more and more data as drivers put more mileage onto those cars. So if you think about that, fundamentally, it's a completely different business model. One becomes a tech company, a software company, subscription company. Another is a hardware, traditional release. You know, I'm selling you a car and I'm updating the car physically world. Very different business model. So that's the transition we had to go through as a software company. Go from shipping CDs and updating with new CDs once a year to then actually running a piece of software that everybody uses, but then has all the nuance and sophistication that enterprise customers expect and demand. So we talk about cloud operations, cloud security. Effectively, we're running the software for them, and they're just using the software to manage their data. And of course, we have zero trust there. So that means none of our folks touch or see any of your data. So, and all those ISO certifications, security certifications, ransomware detection and recovery, and all the complexity. That's why I say it's complicated, right? That deal with cloud and hybrid environment, data residency, all of that have to come into consideration.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds to me like I think the big takeaway there is it is a very much a change in mindset as you move from an on-prem delivery model to a cloud-based delivery model, even if it is for your own applications. But it also sounds to me like, as I think about things like tenant rings and so forth, there's an architectural set of constructs.
That's right.
There's a behavioral set of constructs, as you said, that sort of two-weekly release cycle. It's a more iterative, continuous delivery, agile type approach. Would that be fair to say?
Right. So architecturally, mindset is all different. So we're leveraging DevOps, agile development method. So you're actually releasing new features much, much faster than you had done before. You're able to get real-time feedback from your customers much faster. So that's the release model.
Hidden difference, if you're not an economist, between software and a SaaS model is the marginal cost with SaaS. There are some actual considerable fixed costs that you don't get in software, as you say, where you shoot off another copy of it and it costs you basically, it's asymptotic to zero.
Yeah.
In the cloud model, every additional copy, which is a customer or a tenant, has real costs associated with it. So there are some economic differences as well, right?
There's absolutely massive economic difference. And also recently, the CEO of Computer Center in Europe was saying that, you know, cloud software is great for companies and great for the partner ecosystem, but not so great for the customer, because total cost of ownership is higher. That is true, right? So, but exactly.
I'm doing the 50-50 sign for everyone watching.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
But what it does is it forces everyone to be good citizens to say, whatever I'm using, whatever I'm consuming, I'm actually using it. I'm consuming it. I see value. The moment I stop seeing value, I just unsubscribe. Right? So that forces the providers to be much better providers. It get rid of the age-old, you know, shelfware problem that many software companies and enterprise customers have, that they buy software and when the person who knows the software leave the organization, nobody know how to utilize the software anymore. So yeah, it's actually a virtuous cycle, right? Yes, there is consumption and yes, there is wastage. There's still wastage in cloud. There's estimated that 60% of the compute and consumption, even storage, is actually considered wastage. And there's a whole industry that exists now to reduce that wastage. So what it does is, yes, it's operational expenditure, but it keeps the provider honest. Just very much like Netflix has to spend billions and billions generating interesting content. Otherwise, nobody will watch their stuff and people will subscribe. Same problem.
look, mate, trust me. I remember the days when I'd meet with clients of mine where we'd be talking about what their infrastructure usage was like on-prem. And we'd point to a rack of servers and we'd say, look, what does that do? And they'd turn to you sheepishly and kind of go, we don't know. And one of them said, every now and again, we like turn stuff off just to see who complains, because we're not sure. It's consuming power and cooling and all of these things, but we have no idea what it's doing. So as you say, we're going to talk about sprawl in a minute, but I guess ultimately that's one of the problems with technologies. It's very easy to acquire. It's even easier to forget about if you're not careful, and it just continues to grow.
So Paul, exactly. So sprawl is such a problem that despite the reduction in hardware cost of storing data over time, right? With Moore's Law, of course, we're now running against the wall on Moore's Law. There's only so much minimization we can do on hardware level, you know, until we have to completely change the paradigm with quantum computing, etc. But the increase in data volume and the people's need to store them outpaces much more than decreasing the hardware. So overall, even in cloud and on-prem, businesses are spending more and more on storage. So that's
there's a name for it that goes back to the industrial age, which is Jevons paradox, right? So as the price of producing energy with coal because of steam engines went down because the efficiency went up, people just used more coal, right?
And so that's right.
Yeah, so it's the same with data. So let's talk a bit about this then. So what's number one? Tell us a bit about AvPoint. What is it you do? And then let's get on to what this data sprawl problem is about and how I can start to get control of it.
Yeah, AvPoint today is the largest Microsoft cloud-focused SaaS data management provider. So we focus on helping people protect, manage, and integrate their data in Microsoft Cloud, specifically unstructured business data. So we actually help folks actually manage the hybrid environments of on-prem to cloud. And once the data is in cloud, what to do with it? So the lifecycle management, access control management, governance, who has access to what, from where, and at what time. Those are very, very important topics for large enterprises. And then, of course, sunsetting of that.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you here because I guess the big... talking about myth busting today is the other big myth I guess I hear a lot is, hey, I'm migrating to the cloud to reduce my management complexity, to get rid of all of these problems. Hey, I've moved it to Office 365. I no longer have a data management problem. That's Microsoft's problem to worry about now. Tell us what the reality is.
The reality is much more nuanced than that, right? Microsoft provides they're a hyperscaler. They will provide one platform that works for 380 million users. So that's a small business down the street. That's a mom and pop shop in accounting, you know, to IRS and American Express. So the needs of those clients are very, very different. So our core business is really in the regulated industry, in government, so where people really care about who has access to what and what to do with those data from a regulatory perspective and also from a security perspective. So anybody that touches regulatory industry, accounting firms or consulting firms or architecture firms also have to worry about those things. Take a very simple example of GDPR, which is data privacy consideration regulation in Europe. And now that is becoming common, where you want to be able to protect people's private PII, personal identifiable data, and be able to purge that when someone asks you to, the right to forget. So all those things means data have to be correctly tagged and have the right taxonomy management. Those nuances, the hyperscaler platform provider do not get into. It's too costly. And of course, not everybody need those things, but a significant portion of businesses and regulated industry do need those things. And that's our bread and butter, because we came from the enterprise content management space for big businesses that worry about and care about data governance and data lifecycle management. And then now in cloud, that type of functionality is needed by everyone that actually work in that space as well.
Yeah. I want to follow on from that, because I guess back in the days of on-prem, companies like, I'll pick on EMC because they're the big target in the world of storage. Because storage seems to have this particularly unique problem in that people create it, stick it on a server somewhere, and then forget about it. A bit like those servers I was talking about. And so there seems to just be more and more storage required all the time. Okay, great. So I've moved from on-prem to off-prem. All you've done is moved the problem to a different environment where you get an annual bill.
That's right.
For stuff that you may not be using. So do you also, is AvPoint or someone looking at the problem of all of this underutilized or maybe overstored data? I don't know the right phrase to use.
Absolutely. That's what we call
data sprawl, I guess. Dark data.
Dark data, I like.
Tell us a bit about
what you have.
Yeah.
And we just need to move all this stuff. So we always use an analogy when you move a house, right? You go from house A to house B.
Yep.
Do you just move everything and put them exactly where they were in house A? No, right? You get rid of stuff. You have a yard sale. You know, you go to Salvation Army and you move to a new house with a new structure and you buy other stuff. Same thing happens on data. So we actually have data analytics services where we talk about out-of-date, trivial, and redundant data that we get rid of. We actually help Toyota in Australia when they move to cloud, reduce the amount of that type of data by 90%. So they only have to move 10% of 90%. Data into cloud.
How much money 90%. Did they save? How much money did they save?
Just wait, if you actually look at the run rate cost of storing data, a lot of money, right? Because that's going into future. So people, you have to also now have this mindset of having really good data hygiene. So taxonomy, labeling, and lifecycle management becomes important. So then automatically through software, it will recertify and who has access to what. And also, for example, we have Microsoft as Teams, right? Salesforce, Slack. Should those channels and chats reside forever? No, most companies actually don't want that, right? So, you know, 3 years later, if you get into some sort of legal discovery, they're going to be, if, as long as you have it, you have to present everything. So there's different type of push and pull around how much data you retain and how much data you actually do just get rid of. And all of that is not handled by the platform. So we are the one that actually have software that automatically clean up and do lower tier storage. Even sometimes customer want to ship those data to tape and store in Iron Mountain's data warehouse, actual physical warehouse somewhere. So that is this ongoing process of cleansing, of reducing amount of data that you have. At the same time, the opposite need of, hey, I want to get more intelligence out and actionable intelligence out of my legacy data. And because customer data is the new gold, right? So how do we analyze that data to make sense of it? But how much of that data do you really need? So my background is data mining, machine learning. The most difficult challenge, which still happens today, is data cleansing, because it's otherwise a trash in, trash out problem. How do you actually make sure the stuff that you're working with to generate business intelligence is actually good stuff, clean data, right? That actually lead to the right conclusion and get to the right outcome.
Yeah, and I suppose that challenge must be even more complicated when you're dealing with unstructured data, because the definition of clean in something that's more conceptual, that's more meaning oriented, must be more just a gnarlier problem, I'm guessing, isn't it?
That's right. Yes. So companies actually go into this whole data architecture, data taxonomy practice. So there's a whole segment, right? You talk about EMC. So EMC bought this company called HP Trim. And ESC had this software called Documentum that they sold to OpenText. So that's in the old legacy world, on-prem, there's the whole space around record management, data classification, and data cleansing, except it's a siloed approach. You have to check in and check out separate systems. So nobody use it. We take that approach and we apply it across all the data people have, enterprises have, businesses have in Microsoft Cloud. Basically, your emails, your files, entire Office 365, M365, Microsoft calls it. So we actually do that type of data analysis, analytics, and lifecycle management where you work. There's no separate check-in and check-out process. So ideally, you actually get more intelligence and more bang for the buck out of your everything that you work on, all the business data you work on.
I love it. That's absolutely amazing. Let's talk a little bit about how that's, I guess, the problem is made more complicated by this shift to hybrid work, because I meet so many people now who are working both between, you know, in office and on the road. It seems to be far more common now. It used to just be, you know, your sales reps and a few people who, you know, have the laptop and be traveling about. Now it seems to be everybody is spending their life sort of somewhere between work and home. A lot of them with BYOD, bring your own device environments. And then I'd add another layer of complexity to that, which, as you pointed out, is that nation states are now becoming more focused on things like data residency, where the data actually physically is stored. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that management challenges? Because I know a lot of the cloud vendors are having to deal with this problem themselves, so they're anticipating it. But I imagine both of those things must make this problem a little more complicated.
That's exactly right. So from an anti-globalization perspective, every country wants sovereignty over their own domain, which includes data. So that's regulation, that's data sovereignty. But when you look at hyperscalers, not everything is as clean. So even Microsoft Cloud, for example, they have this search engine called Office Graph, which actually allow you to have much better intelligence around all the documents you work on within the corporate infrastructure. The issue is the Office Graph is actually centrally located in US. Then that creates some problem because you have metadata about the documents that are not data sovereignly residing. So those are continue to be the case. And this is an ongoing process with each enterprise customer and what they can live with. You know, the reality of the world is messy, right? And there's regulation and there's reality. And you always run into that. And these are the tough problems that we actually actively work with in customers day in, day out to actually resolve those so they can continue to operate their businesses. Now, remote work introduced another layer. So employees working from home, leveraging their own devices, bringing on BYOD, right? Bring on devices to work or using corporate devices, except they're outside the corporate network. And how do you ensure that security to happen? And that's actually a big problem set as well. Because if you actually, again, going back to hyperscalers, Microsoft use Teams, Salesforce use Slack, the very nature of those platforms is to make them accessible and available to everyone. So it's easy to share. But once you do that for enterprises, you actually don't want the whole thing to be a town square, right? You want to actually have control. You want to have, hey, finance department have this data set. And if this finance guy now changes job and go to the marketing department, he or she cannot have access to that previous set of documents. So this is happening much, much faster in today's work environment. So there's often a joke that people update their LinkedIn profile much faster than internal HR update their job titles and management structure and provisioning status, which is true, right? So you need to have actually software to automate this as much as possible for you. So then again, fundamentally, it boils down to who has access to what, when, and from where, and with whom. So that's really, you know, sounds simple, but to implement that across on-prem, remote work, different geos, it become a problem that, again, Microsoft is a giant platform. They're not going to have the time to deal with these individualized problems. They want to focus on the $100 billion opportunity. That's Activision, that's GitHub, that's LinkedIn. So yeah, that saves tens of billions of opportunity for partner like AvePoint to help businesses solve these challenges.
Right. So, hey, look, I know we're reaching the top of the hour and you're a very busy man. I really have to thank you so much for your time. And it's just been an incredibly insightful conversation. Parting thoughts for our listeners. What are some of the questions they should be asking themselves to work out if maybe they've got a data sprawl problem that needs solving?
Yeah. So check out the resources. We actually have a great set of resources, appoint.com/blog. We talk about those from an industry perspective, point people to the right places to be educated on those topics. There's plenty of things one can do. Everything is technology, people, and process, right? So technology itself does not solve all the problems. There's a lot of education internally, how to be digital natives and how to be responsible. Corporate digital natives are very different things, and also make that part of your business process. If we talk about, hey, what is true, you know, digital transformation? It's not about lift and shift your existing infrastructure to cloud and call it a day. It's actually about maximizing technology, the capability of it to achieve better outcome for your business, reinvent your business. And this is why when you talk to people like Forrester and Gartner, they all say we are only 2% of the way there to actually transform the business into a digital business. And every business have to do that because regardless of this anti-globalization climate, the momentum of globalization is still there. There's more trade happen digitally. There's much more interaction globally and collaboration happen globally across physical borders than ever before. So the actual momentum of globalization is happening regardless of regulation. So that means for businesses to remain competitive, to be able to thrive into the future, they have to be able to become technology savvy, right? Data savvy and learn how to maximize their subject matter expertise in their industry. So these are things that you have the right mindset, the growth mindset, and then go out and learn and educate yourself.
TJ, just an absolutely fabulous conversation. Final question for you. The show's sponsor, Rocket Software. Thank you again, Rocket. They've got a set of values they talk about that matter to them. Empathy, humanity, trust, and love. Just curious, what matters to you right now?
Yeah. Right now, what matters is...
Right now,
it's really empathy really matters. We are in very, very highly uncertain and volatile environments. There's just so much that's happening, right? And I think overall, people are stressed out. You know, there's inflation, there's economic stagnation, and everyone's waiting for the shoe to drop, talk about the big R, recession. And of course, we have the election happening Tuesday here in America. I think it's really, as business leaders, we need to be empathetic. We need to be that anchor, be that steady anchor for our people. And we're super lucky to be in the industry that we are in, an industry that's highly growing and transformative, that's highly relevant into the future. And but we have to be empathetic. We have to understand where folks' problems are, you know, and concerns are, and help reside them. Not everybody can be Elon Musk and, you know, go do whatever they want to do.
Very, very true. And I think that's probably for the best. But yeah, I think that's great advice. Try and walk a mile in the other person's shoes, because, you know, looking at the world through their lens might help you understand where they're coming from. And, you know, maybe we can meet each other halfway, right?
That's right.
TJ, just I cannot thank you enough for your time. Really, very much enjoyed the conversation. And hopefully you all did too. Thanks again to Rocket Software for bringing us another episode of Digital Disrupted. And thank you all for listening in. If you like what you've heard, as I mentioned at the start of the show, please give us a thumbs up on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you happen to be listening. You can also reach out to me on the Twitter, assuming it still exists by the time the show airs. @XTheStreams is my handle. The show sponsor at Rocket. If you've got any questions for our guests, such as TJ, or ideas for topics you'd like to hear covered, we'd love to hear from you. We'll respond again, assuming it's still there. With that, we'll see you all next week. We won't see you. It's a podcast, but you know what I mean.
Thank you, Paul. Such a pleasure.
See you all next week. Stay disruptive, everyone.